The Appropriations Committee will come to order. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Leak.
Here.
Vice Chair McClure.
Here.
Committee Whip Mooney.
Here.
Ranking Member Driscoll.
Here.
Representatives Altman. Andrade.
Here.
Bell.
Here.
Benjamin. Brannon.
Here.
Posada Cabrera. Cheney.
Here.
Daly.
Here.
Fine.
Here.
Garrison. Gottlieb.
Here.
Grant.
Here.
Gregory, excused. Honchowski.
Here.
Masullo.
Here.
Payne.
Here.
Perez, excused. Rommel.
Here.
Sosman. Schoaf.
Here.
Silvers, excused. Skidmore.
Here.
Stevenson, excused. Tomko, excused. Williams.
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Appropriations Committee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. We're going to move straight into business today. Members, today we'll hear two presentations. The first presentation will be an update on emergency preparedness and response for Hurricane Idalia by Chris Spencer, Director of the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget. Second presentation concerns the long-range financial outlook by Amy Baker, Coordinator, Office of Economic and Demographic Research. Mr. Spencer, you are recognized.
There we go. Good morning, Chair Leak and members of the House Appropriations Committee. This presentation will provide an update on the cost impacts of Hurricane Idalia response and a general status of the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund to date. I guess I'm managing my own. There we go. For background, the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund was established in 2022 as the primary funding source for the state's response to an emergency declared by the governor. General revenue is appropriated annually into the fund, and the Legislative Budget Commission is authorized to make transfers to the fund throughout the year to meet the needs of the fund. In addition to state appropriations to the fund, the federal government provides financing through FEMA to meet the needs of an emergency declared by the governor. These FEMA funds are generally divided into two types of vehicles, a standard project worksheet and an expedited project worksheet. Standard project worksheets reimburse the state for eligible expenditures made by the state from state resources and are done on a federal cost share that is determined by the total cost of the event. Funds received from standard project worksheet reimbursements are deposited into the EPRF, but should then be transferred back to general revenue funds to account for the prior transfers that have been made into the EPRF. Federal cost share is determined by the cumulative cost of an event, and the current cumulative cost threshold for a standard 75-25 match, which means 75% covered by FEMA, 25% covered by the state, is approximately $40 million. So basically any hurricane usually triggers that 75-25 threshold. And the trigger to hit a 90-10, which we just hit for Hurricane Ian, is approximately $3.7 billion. Event-specific cost share is often issued as well, in addition to the 75-25 and 90-10 splits. For example, for Hurricane Idalia, we received 100% federal cost share for both emergency protective measures and debris removal. And for Hurricane Ian, we received 100% cost share for those activities for 90 days. Expedited project worksheets authorize 50% of the projected cost for an eligible expenditure to be available upfront for the state to draw and spend. As that first 50% of funds are spent, the expedited project worksheet then converts to a standard project worksheet for reimbursement of the remainder of the obligation. The state uses expedited project worksheets during the response to an emergency to reduce the cash need from the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund, maximizing the availability of federal funds and cash flowing some portions of the emergency response and recovery process for a declared event. This slide shows the total amount of state appropriations that have been made to the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund since it was established in 2022. In total, $2.92 billion of state funds have been transferred into the fund. An additional $621 million has been drawn into the fund from FEMA expedited project worksheets, and in total, $2.6 billion has been expended from the fund. This slide shows a breakdown of the standard versus expedited project worksheet development for the three major emergencies since the creation of the fund. That includes Hurricane Ian, Nicole, and Idalia. These project worksheets are in varying stages of development through the FEMA process, and some may not be available for draw for several years. For reference, we are still receiving Hurricane Michael project worksheet payments, and we're still about to start receiving some major reimbursements for COVID expenditures from several years ago. Prior to Hurricane Idalia, the state estimated future reimbursements of more than $2.8 billion for prior events. That includes $400 million for events from 2022 and prior, including Hurricane Michael going all the way back several years before that, as well as at least $800 million for COVID expenditures. When received, these reimbursements benefit the General Revenue Fund as non-recurring general revenue. And in total, for these three events on the slide here, we have $4.85 billion worth of project worksheets that are currently in process, with the bulk of that being for Hurricane Ian. This slide shows the total breakdown of actual expenditures, pending obligations, and projected expenditures for each current emergency actively worked by the Division of Emergency Management. Operation Vigilant Sentry and the Texas deployment from Operation Vigilant Sentry are not FEMA reimbursable, and the recent Israel activation is also not a FEMA reimbursable event, so we have the asterisks there for those. Note that these numbers are a moving target. Projections will gradually decrease as those expenditures shift to obligations and when purchase orders are issued, and those obligations will then shift to actual expenditures as work is invoiced and validated for future payment. Entirely separate from the FEMA financing process, the Federal Highway Administration reimburses DOT for eligible expenditures during a federally declared disaster. This slide shows the amount of expenditures for Hurricanes Ian, Nicole, and Idalia that were incurred by DOT that will be reimbursed by FHWA and do not represent a fiscal need from the EPRF outside of the state participation requirement that's reflected in the middle column there, the $65.8 million. So factoring in the inputs from all the previous slides for fund sources, expenditures, and pending obligations, we arrive at an estimated cash balance need for the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund of $59 million. And note that the $508 million under total federal EPW funds available, not drawn, represents funds that are not drawn and remain available to satisfy expenditures as invoices are received. So those are funds that are available through the EP expedited project worksheet process that are in our SmartLink account with FEMA. We will draw those funds to satisfy invoices as they are received. When we reflect a negative balance in the fund on this table, that does not mean that the fund is negative today. The current cash balance of the fund is actually right now just under $1 billion. Many invoices for work performed will take some time to be validated for payment. For example, the debris mission for Hurricane Ian concluded 2 months ago, and invoices are still being submitted for that work, and the non-congregate sheltering mission for Hurricane Ian remains underway and will go into the next calendar year. This slide reflects the activity by the Division of Emergency Management related specifically to Hurricane Idalia, along with a breakout of the five largest categories of expenditure types for this specific event. These categories are consistent with the biggest categories of costs for any major hurricane. Field logistics and warehousing is a major cost, particularly depending on the amount of logistical staging areas established during the response to an event. Debris is another major expense for any hurricane response, and Hurricane Idalia was handled differently than Hurricane Ian. That's why the debris number here for DEM's costs are so much lower than they would otherwise have been during Hurricane Ian. The difference there being that during Hurricane Ian, due to the nature of the debris and the extent of the catastrophic damage, DEM assumed the entire debris mission for all commercial, private, vegetative, waterway, and titled vessel debris removal. During Hurricane Idalia, which was largely a vegetative debris event, the state assigned different debris missions to DOT, DEP, FWC, and DEM, depending on the type of debris. Back up to the logistics issue for a while. That will be generally the largest expense that you'll see. It will be for sure for Hurricane Idalia. It was a significant expense also for Hurricane Ian. Logistical staging areas and base camps become very expensive. And depending on how long those are deployed, for how long the need is on the ground, that those costs continue to accrue. As we try to project out, and so when you see the projections versus the encumbrances, we changed things up during Hurricane Idalia to try to better account for what we think the total cost of the event is going to be. During Hurricane Ian, we were looking at 30-day invoices. So as 30 days went by, then you triggered another 30-day expense, and that would be reflected on the projections column. So as the staff for both the House and Senate Appropriations Committees can attest to, that number grew over time because every 30-day increment that went by, that number started to balloon. It was a significant deployment of resources. With Hurricane Idalia, we've implemented a new strategy based on the severity of the storm, whether it's a Category 5, 4, 3, 2, all the way down to 1, all the way down to a tropical storm. We now do different durations of purchase order for estimating purposes. So you'll do either 120 days for estimating purposes if it's a Category 3 or higher. You might go down to only 30-day increments if it's less than a Category 3. With Hurricane Idalia, that ended up causing us to initially overproject what those expenses might actually have been, because turns out we didn't need to have those logistical staging areas deployed for as long as we were projecting them to be, given the severity of Hurricane Idalia at landfall. So those numbers started coming down. So it was the inverse what happened with Hurricane Ian. And that just goes back to the point of these numbers are always a moving target. You don't really know how long you're going to have these assets deployed in the field. You don't really know how long you're going to need to deploy further assets as you're coming across areas. Debris is a very difficult number to lock down. The Army Corps of Engineers always gives us initially an estimate of how much debris is out there. Usually it's on the low end, sometimes double, triple, or quadruple is how much debris you end up actually coming across. And then you're paying for that debris as you're removing it. So these numbers evolve over time, and that's why we are very pleased with the statutory construct that allows for us to come to you and to the Legislative Budget Commission to be able to seek funds throughout the year and not, you know, have to wait one time throughout the year to get an appropriation in the fund. It works very, very well, and we've been able to get the resources that we need into the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund to satisfy those obligations. With that, that concludes my update for Hurricane Idalia and the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund. I'd be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, members. Are there any questions? Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I'm curious if why we're relying on the projections of the Army Corps of Engineers if they're routinely inaccurate.
Mr. Chairman.
Spencer, you recognize?
It's one of the tools that we use. It's one of the best tools that we have available to us. We also do some of our own projections based on sending our own staff there in the field to go and make the counts. But the Army Corps offers that every time after a major event. So they'll tell us what, based on their aerial surveys, what they think the debris is. We use it as kind of a benchmark to start from and then go from there. But it helps to have something to work with rather than just waiting for several weeks to send enough people driving around and flying around ourselves to go try to count it. But we do our own surveys as well. We also rely on the local counties to give us what they project issues to be as far as the amount of debris on the ground. So all of that factors into what we think ultimately will be the universe for debris removal.
Second question. Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the balance in the fund, When we're finished with the three hurricanes that we're currently working with, what will be left for the next hurricane?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
So right now, if we paid all invoices that we are forecast to receive, that we think that we're going to get, and if those invoices end up being what we think they're going to be, right now the fund balance is negative by $59 million. We haven't released the governor's budget yet. We are going to recommend another appropriation into the budget every year into that fund, and as has been consistent in prior years. So if the governor recommends $1 billion into that fund each year, prior 2 years, legislature's appropriated $500 million each year. So if $500 million is appropriated, that would satisfy, basically leave $440 million left over. Now, anytime there's a hurricane, a major hurricane, particularly Hurricane Idalia, already costs more than that, right? So the way that we view that balance in the fund, that's your starting balance to make sure that there's cash in the bank to make sure you're satisfying any kind of invoices that might come in throughout the year. When there's a major event, we're going to have to come back to the Legislative Budget Commission and ask for more funds. But that's where the process exists now for us to be able to show us what we think the costs are going to be, request funding, have the funding transferred in, continue the response operations.
Representative Masullo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Spencer, for your presentation. Unfortunately, our state has experienced a lot of storms in the last 15 years, but fortunately, we've collected all the data. Have you considered, besides using some of your predictive models that you have been using models that would incorporate inflation, the storms, where they hit, the magnitude, and try to do some generative AI to predict what you might need given a particular storm when it hits the state at a particular area?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, if the legislature would be inclined to appropriate some resources to do some generative AI modeling, we'd be very receptive to that proposal.
We'll take a look at that. Good. Any other questions? Representative Driscoll, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Spencer. And you probably went over this, and I apologize if I just missed it. On page 6, there's OVS and OVSLS. What is that? What are those abbreviations for?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, so OVS stands for Operation Vigilant Sentry. That is the current state of emergency declared for mass migration along the Florida Keys and Southwest Florida, Southeast Florida. OVSLS, that's Lone Star, Operation Lone Star. That is the Texas deployment of Florida resources over to the Southwest border.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So when you add up the OVS, the OVSLS, and the Israel evacuation, all of which were non-FEMA reimbursable emergency declarations, could you talk about or explain the policy choice that was made to do that, understanding that we were headed towards a negative projected cash balance?
Mr. Chairman. The governor felt that it was important to declare a state of emergency for those issues. So over a year ago now for the mass migration situation, and then more recently for the Israel evacuation operation, the governor has his constitutional authority to declare that state of emergency. It's not as sequential to say at the time that we're making a decision like that, that we think the balance is going to be negative. That is a moving target. Sometimes that number will grow and decrease as we are validating invoices that we receive, as we're receiving invoices, as we're working on projections. Those numbers may come down, they may come up. So sometimes we will have a snapshot that indicates that fund may have a future negative balance, and then a month later it may not have a future negative balance, and then another month later it may have a negative balance. So it really is a moving target as we're trying to factor in a lot of these not yet refined numbers for projections on some of these things. Until we receive an actual invoice for work done, particularly around debris, around the non-congregate sheltering for housing missions, for other works performed that are on like a durational basis, until we actually receive the invoices and then close out what that open purchase order looks like for that particular mission, we don't know exactly how much of that projection is going to materialize. And then once we have that invoice, we can refine that in, close out what we think the projection is going to be, and then have a more refined number. So it's a moving target.
Members, I want to point out that we've already had the question and answer and debate on the OVS and OVSLS as they were parts of prior budgets. But if we want to focus on the Israel evacuation, you're welcome. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At what point did you realize that there would be a negative projected cash balance?
Mr. Spencer.
Probably in the last month or so is when we started to back out some of the FHWA expenditures related to Hurricane Idalia and started to refine that number. And now we're starting to receive invoices for debris for Hurricane Ian. So that's now being loaded in.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. And understanding that a negative projected cash balance does not look like a good thing, right? Like this looks like a blemish on our financial planning. Could you provide some context? Has this happened before? Is this a typical thing? Is this an anomaly?
Let me, if I can, jump in there. We put money into this fund as kind of a placeholder without knowing how many storms or emergencies were going to happen. That's kind of the nature of emergencies. So that money goes in as kind of a placeholder, and it should not be unexpected or uncommon that when you have years in which there are an unusual number of emergencies or unusually costly emergencies that may require more money. But Mr. Spencer, if you'd like to elaborate.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So this fund's only been around since 2022, but after Hurricane Ian, there were several times where we were negative. Now, again, negative not meaning that we're actually negative at that point in time, because, again, we have almost $1 billion of cash currently in that fund. It's negative if you were to satisfy all potential obligations that are encumbered against that fund at some point over the next year. So as far as the cash flow for that fund goes, we are very comfortable. We're actually not requesting a LBC amendment during this calendar year for the fund, because when we look at the all of the worksheets that are currently in process with FEMA, what we know we're going to get obligated, what we know we're going to receive, we believe that there's going to be adequate cash flow to be able to manage those expenditures at least through session. So,
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. For clarification, you believe there's adequate cash flow in terms of the FEMA reimbursements are going to cover everything that's outstanding, or is it that we're going to have to take money from general revenue to offset this projected negative cash balance?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Spencer.
Depending on how much we get obligated and when we get it obligated by FEMA, we think that FEMA will cover most of that. We may need the $50 million or so from GR in the current fiscal year. We are making an assumption that there will be another appropriation for the next fiscal year into the fund. And so if that doesn't happen, then we may have to have a different analysis. But between the money that we know that we're going to receive from FEMA, the thing with trying to predict FEMA, it's kind of like having a crystal ball. You're not sure how fast they're going to actually move on certain things. And so just knowing what's currently in the queue and where they are in the stages of the queue at FEMA, we're pretty comfortable that we're going to get a significant amount of cash for some of the major big ticket expenditures that are incoming, particularly non-congregate sheltering and debris.
And members, just another word on this. Remember when we created this fund, as a state that is prone to hurricanes, we found it responsible to start setting aside some money to deal with the emergencies that we should reasonably anticipate, and we had to arbitrarily pick an amount, but that's how we got here. And figuring that if we had leftover money, we could take it back. If we needed more money, we would come back and supplement through the LBC. You got one more? Because I want to go to somebody else. And,
oh, do you guys have questions?
Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As you spoke of the negative $59 million that may occur, why is it taking so long for the reimbursement to be paid out at this point?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman. Again, the federal process with FEMA takes time. We're still waiting on some reimbursements for Hurricane Michael, for example. It's just the process with FEMA to actually go and receive those funds. It's very difficult to predict how quickly we'll get some of these standard reimbursements through the process, but at some point over the next 3 to 5 years, that's when we get a lot of these reimbursements that start coming in for a major event. So Hurricane Michael, we're still getting reimbursements for. There's still some outstanding, but we've gotten a lot of money back for Hurricane Michael. COVID, we're still waiting for $800 million for COVID. And then when we start talking about Hurricane Ian, we're right now in the bulk of where FEMA's working on the standard reimbursements. Those should be coming in over the next several years.
Representative Williams, recognize.
Is there a cutoff period for us to actually do that reimbursement? And will that increase the $59 million that we have the negative?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, there's not a cutoff period for submitting that. There is a cutoff period there's a 365 days from the actual presidential declaration of a major event within which whatever you get obligated as far as a project worksheet to be reimbursed from FEMA, you get a portion of that back to the state in the form of hazard mitigation grant dollars. We are getting back $1 billion for Hurricane Ian. So DEM has moved faster than they've ever done before for a prior event, getting things obligated for Hurricane Ian, implementing new processes, including some of the technology solutions that the legislature appropriated during the last fiscal year to speed up that process. So we are very pleased with the speed at which we're able to do that. It's not going to really change that $59 million number unless we get some additional project worksheets paid out for reimbursement faster than we were forecasting. The one caveat to that is that, again, for standard project worksheets, think of that as a pure reimbursement. State has spent a dollar on something. FEMA's paying us back either 75% of that dollar or 90% of that dollar, and that money's coming back. The way that the law is currently set up is that we would receive those funds into the Emergency Response Fund. We would then transfer those funds to general revenue. because that benefits general revenue. If there's a decision made by the legislature to allow those funds to be retained in that fund, if there is a deficit, for example, then those reimbursements that come back would then satisfy that deficit.
Any questions? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the office of the governor knew about a month ago that we were headed towards a projected negative cash balance, was the decision for the evacuation made knowing that it would further drive us towards that negative cash balance?
Mr. Spencer?
Mr. Chairman, we don't make decisions on responding to an emergency around whether or not there's adequate cash in the fund. Honestly, if there is an emergency and there is a response that's needed, the governor has issued a state of emergency, we will do whatever it takes in order to make sure that we're responding to that event. Reconciling the fund is something that we deal with on an accounting basis to make sure that we can satisfy those obligations. But when there's an emergency declared, we respond.
As necessary to help people.
Yep.
Representative Driscoll, you have another question?
Thank you, yes, because it just didn't answer it. My question was that decision made knowing that it would drive us towards a negative cash balance? And I understand the decision, what you're saying, right, with is in the governor's providence. If he wants to do it, then he can just declare it as an emergency. But my question was this a decision made knowing that this would drive us towards a negative cash balance?
So I think you're speaking specifically that in that time frame, that decision would have been the Israel evacuation. Was that made knowing that we would have a negative cash balance in that fund?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't say knowing, no, because again, what the actual status of a deficit in that fund is an evolving target. The numbers change regularly depending on what our projections are and what the actual encumbrances that are actually issued are, and the validation of those invoices to see if there's any double counting, if there's any issues from the vendors. We have hundreds of vendors. So I would not say that we made any decision to incur any kind of obligation on the state knowing that it would create a deficit. We know throughout the duration of this fiscal year that there is a strong likelihood that there would be a negative position in that fund. But we're not making a decision knowing that it's going to exacerbate a deficit. A deficit is something that could exist in that fund, regardless of any decision that we made on any additional deployments or any additional activations.
And I'll tell you, members, at the point that we created this fund, again, we picked an arbitrary amount of money to put in there, knowing that there would be times in which there were more emergencies than there was cash planned or set aside for it, and would therefore result in a deficit and would require them to come back to us. So I don't think that the accounting issue of a deficit is something that should alarm anyone. It means that we spent the money that we had allotted, and there was more emergency than anticipated in an average year. Are there any further questions? Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm misunderstanding this a little bit, but we're using data that's incorrect that made these projections, that we're going to have a negative $59 million from our general account, but we still had an additional $1 million go out for an emergency. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something here.
Hold on, give me a second here. I do think your premise is incorrect, but Mr. Spencer, do you want to answer that?
Mr. Chairman, to try to clarify, there's about $1 billion of cash in that fund right now. That $1 billion is obligated for various expenditures that need to be paid out at some point over the next several months. So on an accounting basis, when we receive the invoice, we dock that as an obligation that is docked against that cash balance. From an accounting standpoint, if we pay out everything that we think we owe and everything that we think we could receive, then that's where that negative $59 million comes in. However, we have not paid all those things out. We have not received invoices for a significant amount of that. So we're trying to project forward what we think those invoices may be at the maximum when they come in and are received by the state to validate for payment. And some of those we may not receive until March or April. Some of those we may not receive until the next fiscal year. But we are trying to account for that because we want to make sure that we're getting as accurate as possible of a snapshot of what financial needs are going to be in this fund for the duration of the fund based on the current activations. We have They're responding, I think, to five different open declared disasters right now. So based on the ones that we currently have open and the hundreds of invoices that are received and what we think we could receive in that universe of potential expenditures, that's what we try to forecast out.
Any further questions? Seeing no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Spencer. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Baker, you're recognized.
Yours is.
Mr. Chairman, if you give me just a minute, I'm going to switch the slideshow.
You got it.
Okay, we're going to kind of give an update on the long-range financial outlook today. This is largely, though, the material that we addressed when the Legislative Budget Commission met back in mid-September. So what we are constitutionally required to put together a document that looks out over 3 years in terms of projected expenditures and known revenues and do kind of a glide path to where we would be at the end of those 3 years. So this is the 17th document that we've put together in accordance with the Constitution. The budget drivers are largely related to estimating conferences, but also past legislative actions. We look at what the legislature has done usually over the last 3 years to develop an average that we bring forward into the plan, and revenue drivers, which are mostly based on the national and Florida economic forecasts, also population growth, and then those drive a series of estimating conferences as well. So this year, we're looking at fiscal year 24-25, 25-26, and 26-27. So 24-25 is probably the year you're most focused on at this point, since that'll be the budget you're putting together for next year. So quite a few things really haven't been updated because the data hasn't changed since we met over the summer and put everything together for the long-range financial outlook. GDP is one of those. The data is currently delayed. We're not going to be getting it probably for another month, but our current forecast assumes that we grew about 3% in fiscal year 22-23, and that we're going to drop to a more characteristic 2.5% this year before we have a kind of a slowdown moving into next year of 1.7%, and then coming back to 2.4% in fiscal year 26-27. We focus a lot on GDP, or gross domestic product, for Florida because it's a measure of how the state is growing. It's probably the most accurate measure that we have. So we take this information, we look at it in real terms, which is inflation-adjusted terms, and it can tell us how we're comparing against other states. Essentially, it's a measure of all the goods and services produced in Florida. Florida personal income is a slightly different version of that. It's also a good metric to compare us to other states, but it's also very affected by what's happening in various congressional actions, in different entitlement programs that have scheduled increases in them, and other things. So it is more affected by the environment that we're in. But still, about 67% of it, or two-thirds, across the nation is driven by wages and salaries, which is very important for us to keep an eye on. In Florida, it's not quite that strong. We're closer to 50% because of the large percentage of our population that's retirement-based. What we're looking at now is that the state's income expanded a strong about 7.8% in 22-23, largely because of that strong salary growth we were seeing. and we expect it's going to step down to about 5.6% this year and then 5.9% next year before settling in around 4%, which is what we think is more characteristic. Relative to what we knew in September, we do have one more quarter of data here, and it came in largely as we expected, so no surprises. The current employment conditions, this is real-time information. We get this much faster than either of the two metrics that we had before. So we are now up to September data, and through September, you can see that Florida continues on the good side of both of our two key metrics. One is job creation, that's your top graph, and then the second one is unemployment rate, that's your bottom graph. So you can see Florida in both cases is in the blue. And really since the peak of COVID, we've been, in terms of job creation, running a little bit higher than the U.S. as a whole. That continued on through September. We were at 2.5% year-over-year growth. The U.S. as a whole was at 2%. And then in terms of the unemployment rate, we're in September running at 2.8%, and the U.S. as a whole was running at 3.8%. So just a word about what 2.8% means. So if you look back through all of our modern history, the strongest we've ever been was in the first, in terms of having a very low unemployment rate, was back in the first half of 2006. So right at the peak of the Florida's housing boom and economy was roaring, we had an unemployment rate of 2.4%. So when we're at 2.8%, we're not that far off the record that we had in that first half of 2006. What it tells you is that we don't have a lot of slack. We're running very, very tight. Our labor market is still tight in Florida as it is in the nation as a whole. We do expect as the Federal Reserve continues to take actions and maintain tight fiscal policy, that this unemployment rate will start eking up. We expect for the entire year this year that we're going to run about 3%, a little bit higher, and then continue increasing slowly until we get to about 4.3% in the last year of the three-year outlook. Why that's important is we really think the economy is much more efficient and in a better place if you run at about 4% unemployment rate. We consider that enough slack in the labor market that people can change jobs, they can move in and out of the state, and things just continue operating without any pressure. When you're as low as we are in the unemployment rate, that also feeds into that upward pressure on wages that we just talked about. So spending a moment talking about the wage gap a little bit more in depth, this is probably the most intriguing thing that came out of all the adjustments we were seeing over the course of the summer. So Florida traditionally is considered to be a low-wage state, and we run, depending on what years are included in your average, about 88.5% of the U.S. annual wage on average. So that is what we expect in Florida, and that's typically what we see. We know after we came out of the Great Recession, we actually fell a little bit lower, and then as we went into the pandemic, we fell again. But we started seeing improvement come about 2016 when we were at our low, which was 87.7%, our most recent period where we were at 87.7% to our low in 2020 during the pandemic when we were at 87.3%. So not much below where we normally run, but a little bit below. So what has changed is that as we came out of the pandemic and we saw large numbers of people come back to work, particularly in that leisure and hospitality area, we had a lot of movement all of a sudden and a lot of people trying to hire and needing to offer higher wages to attract people back to work, particularly in that leisure category. And so we saw a big transformation for us beginning when we looked at what was happening in 2021. We moved above our average of 88.5% to 89.2%, so slightly above our long run average. But the mix was very unusual. We had a 4.9% increase in the number of jobs in covered employment, but a 13.2% increase in total wages. So it wasn't just people coming back to work. We were starting to see that wage pressure in 2021. The preliminary data for 2022 indicates that that transformation is continuing and building a little bit. We were, at that point, hitting a ratio of 91.1%, something that we haven't seen since the turn of the century. So much closer to the U.S. average annual wage than we've been. And that it still came from this odd mix. We had a 5.6% increase in the number of jobs in covered employment, but dominated by 11.7% increase in total wages. So Florida, which has typically thought of itself as a low-wage state because of the mix of jobs we have, is now seeing a lot of pressure on wages that we haven't seen before. And that's going to have a lot of ramifications for putting the budget together for next year, and we'll cover that in a moment, but also through the entire 3 years of the long-range financial outlook. Based on what our projections are from the estimating conference this summer, we're expecting average annual wage growth to grow between 3 and 3.8% per each year. So there's not really disinflation or a coming down in wages that's expected as we move forward. This means that at least where we are in wages is probably going to stay. We're probably not going to see any improvement in that. The pace of growth may change in the future, but higher wages essentially are here to stay. So when we look at our biggest economic drivers in the state, by far and away, population growth continues to be our largest population driver. It's driving both employment and income growth. And so it's extremely important to us to note that as we go forward from here to 2030, our growth rate, our population growth rate in Florida is going to be about twice as high as the U.S. population growth rate. So Florida is expected to average about 1.27% per year between now and 2030. The U.S. as a whole is only going to be 0.64%. So we're twice as high. And of that growth we're expecting as we move forward, we expect it all to come from more people moving into the state than are leaving the state. The other component is natural increase, which compares births and deaths. We turned negative already on that metric, and we expect it to stay negative all the way throughout our forecast. Largely, again, because of our population mix. We have such a large senior population that's moving into older and older ages. So all of our growth going forward is going to be from people moving into the state. So talking a little bit more about baby boomers, just to put us in context, at this point in time, 13 of 19 cohorts have entered the retirement phase. So to remind you, a baby boomer is everyone who was born in 1946 through 1964. So we are about two-thirds of the way through moving the baby boomers into retirement age in Florida. our population age 65 and older, as we move ahead, is projected to represent at least 24.4% of the total population in 2030, or a quarter. A quarter of our total population is roughly going to be baby boomers. So a very significant factor. And because we're still on the early phases of that yet, we haven't seen the full impact on the state's budget that will come as they continue to age. The other thing that's important about 2030 is about that point in time, a little bit after, we're going to see our first oldest baby boomers reach age 85. 85 is what we know statistically, chronic issues, chronic conditions, problems with mobility start to really become a factor in person's daily living. So about between now and 2030, we're still on the very strong side of having baby boomers see Florida as such an attractive state. As we move past 2030, we'll be in an area where we start to see challenges come in from that. And all along, of course, our youngest population group is still going to continue to be there and represent about its same share of our total population. And then the last piece we'll mention that's important on the economic side is housing. Clearly, what we have seen most recently as we came out of COVID was driven by the Federal Reserve's actions on interest rates. As they drove those down towards zero, it became very, very attractive for people to buy real estate, to buy construct housing, buy existing homes. And we saw a movement in doc stamp collections, which is most dependent on real estate actions in Florida, to soar to a level we had not ever seen before. So as we hit the peak, we soared to nearly 5.4 million. And you can see, just looking at the graph, how that was such a dramatic and marked change very quickly. We were moving steadily and slowly up from the low after the housing market bust, but the movement we saw in those 2020 and 21 years was not anything that was natural. It was driven by the Federal Reserve's actions. So what we knew and what we saw is by the time we hit 22-23, that was going to come back to normal because that was such an unusual action, and the Federal Reserve began their tightening process, which made it much less attractive to buy real estate or construct new housing. So we saw a 27.9% decline in 22-23, and we're projecting another 10% decline in 23-24. Even though that's 2 years of back-to-back declines, that is a little bit better than what we expected last winter. We had a greater negative, and it would have been not as positive as we even are going to be. So that, and then after that, we expect more typical growth to resume throughout the rest of the forecast. I'm not going to go over the slide in detail, but just to show you what we've been facing pretty much for a year now is this recession tightrope. Are we going to move into a recession? Are we going to avoid a recession? And we've been bouncing on both sides of that question. That largely, this has to do, again, with the Federal Reserve. Are they going to be able to achieve what we're all calling a soft landing, which means we're going to avoid a significant recession? It is just going to be a slowing in the economy. So given that we're going to be close to zero either way, we're either going to be slightly below and in a recession or slightly above and not see remarkable growth over the next year. It's kind of an esoteric question rather than a meaningful question to us. Whether you're one slightly below zero, slightly above zero, the general effect on the economy is about the same, a slowing in projected growth. As we've been looking from the most recent data releases, as we've moved away from the summer conferences, that question and the projections of who we follow the most in terms of seeking guidance is staying about the same. It's not really changed. The one thing I will definitely point out, though, is the last bullet. Even though inflation is starting to improve in that it's not increasing as much as it was, it's still expected to be persistent for quite a few more months. So that is going to be in the back of our mind. More importantly, their medical inflation, which has been really tame and not very much of a factor, is expected to start becoming a greater factor as we go forward. Largely that has to do because it's so labor intensive and the wages are still feeling upward pressure in this tight labor market. That has implications for state employees' health insurance program and Medicaid. So something to, and then some of our other related programs to Medicaid like KidCare. So this is something we'll be facing when we meet again. This is a general revenue forecast that we adopted this summer. Most of you have seen or heard about this by now. We did add significant money all the way through the forecast, largely because we had a recession built into the forecast prior to that that never materialized. So that's a big part of it. As we move forward, we do expect this year, even though it's going to be strong and we added money to it, to be lower in terms of revenue collections than last year. And that largely has to do with the legislative actions to adopt measures affecting revenue, the tax holidays, and other things that we did coming out of session at record-breaking levels. And then also we had a strong boost coming into the forecast last year from Hurricane Ian. The first response to a hurricane is increased activity as recovery tries to take hold. That's largely washed itself out of the forecast by now, so you're losing that boost we got from it. And then there were some other changes we made as well, but those are probably the two largest. So between this year and next year, which will affect the budget you're putting together, we added about $2.7 billion. That is a really significant change that we were able to build into our forecast. This is just showing you the outlook balance. We last year had unallocated general revenue of $19.8 billion. This year, on our official outlook, we had $8.8 billion when this was adopted in September. But we knew coming out of the summer conferences and the work that was done on the long-range financial outlook that we had about $271 million of deficits that we would likely have that would need to be addressed by the upcoming legislature to get through this fiscal year. So that took our official, at that point, $8.8 billion. In our projections for the long-range financial outlook, down to about $8.5 billion. And so bringing that information into a picture of where we are on total state reserves, these days we think of three sources as being the state's reserves. And so that's unallocated general revenue, the budget stabilization fund, and now, just in the last couple years, the emergency preparedness and response fund. So altogether, if you add those three pieces up, the $8.8 billion from unallocated general revenue, the $4.1 billion from the budget stabilization fund, And at the time we took the snapshot in September, $681 million coming in from the Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund, we had about $13.6 billion in reserves available to state for different kinds of emergencies. That meant, which is our metric here, that it was almost 30% of our GR estimate. So very strong, very, if you look back just over the last 10-year period, which is what we have up in the graph, you can see how strong that is. It is stronger than every year, with the exception of last year, where we had the really big unallocated general revenue balance and about 41.3% of the GR estimate. So very, very strong reserves. The most important thing to mention here is that we've been making additional investments into the Budget Stabilization Fund to make sure it's as strong as it could be. We've reached a point now that is getting very close to its constitutional maximum. So it's unlikely we'll be able to put very much more money in there than what we have right now until a few years pass. In terms of critical needs drivers, so we're moving into the budget part, and I'm going to try not to go into a super amount of detail, only because you're already in the process of starting to think about the budget for next year and making changes. But I'm going to focus on kind of the high points. The first one is...
Baker, if you don't mind hitting the high points there, because the reason we're having this meeting is not all of you were at the LBC or had the opportunity to hear from Ms. Baker, but I want to make sure that those of you who weren't there have the opportunity, but we'll probably allow the members to focus you in on some of those areas. So if you'll hit the high points, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay. So we have the critical needs drivers are those things that are very hard for the state to change absent significant law or structural changes. So, for example, the Medicaid program. It's an entitlement program. We participate with the federal government, so very hard for us to change. Other things are constitutionally required, or as a result of a lawsuit, they're required. Of those, we have 14 critical needs drivers this year. We were able to buy a lot of those down by going through and using any available monies from trust funds that were in the same area. So the estimating conference does that as a matter of course within the Medicaid program. So we go through and we look at what dollars are available in trust funds before we fund with general revenue. We do the same thing deliberately as a funding strategy for the long-range financial outlook. So in this case, if you look at which was our strongest, we had a big balance in the state school trust fund that we were able to utilize for the Florida Education Finance Program. So the effect of that is to make, in certain programs, the needs in the second year a little bit stronger than they are in the first year. Because in the first year, we were able to use those balances. And you can see it again on this chart. Here we're adding 28 other high-priority needs drivers in. Those are things that you've funded in most, if not all, of the recent budget years. So we take averages or estimating conference results and bring that into this picture. So here we have the critical needs drivers and the other high-priority needs drivers built added together. The important thing to know about this is that your greatest needs for general revenue are going to come from other high priority needs where you have your greatest flexibility. So you, that is a good mix. It's about one-third, two-thirds, so about two-thirds of your general revenue needs are coming through those other high-priority needs, and you're going to be able to have flexibility in how you design those and fund those. This shows you, this is one of the areas we're not going to go over in super detail, but this shows you the GR drivers by policy area. You can see for the first year, 24-25, human services, natural resource, and statewide issues are the biggest needs for general revenue. You can see again where that second year kind of pops up, and in fact, one result of that is in pre-K through 12 education. So by the time we get to the second year, there, those trust fund balances have been worked through, and you're back again with a higher reliance on general revenue. By the time you get to the third year, the natural resource area is the largest share of the total need. There's two features that we have to bring into account when we're putting the budget side of the long-range financial outlook together. One feature is how much do we have in new drivers each year? So each year, what are the new drivers costing us? What we're seeing this year is new drivers are costing us $14.9 billion, which is roughly twice as much as what we were seeing for the same year last year. So we've increased the size of our budget and what our needs are. And that's true if you look at the comparisons across every single policy area. So the composition is a little different, but all eight policy areas are showing greater needs this year than they did for when we looked ahead last year. The other thing we have to bring in and keep in mind is total GR expenditures each year. And that has to do with where we invested our recurring dollars versus our non-recurring dollars. So if we invest recurring dollars, that means we have that cost to fund every single year thereafter. So you can see the first year, 24-25, between critical needs and other high priority needs, we had almost $4.9 billion in drivers, but 2.55 of that was going to needs to come from recurring drivers. So that means that 2.55 is there that year, 25-26, and 26-27. So it continues to stack all the way through. So when you take into account that some of your investments and drivers have to be recurring, it pushes up your new driver needs to look at all GR expenditures, and that's $22.8 billion. We took account of both effects when we put together the long-range financial outlook. The long-range financial outlook also included some revenue adjustments, as we've been doing for a number of years now. We have really three kinds. The first one used to be a big issue when we were doing this, the trust fund transfers. You can see going forward, based on what we've been doing most recently, they're really a very small piece of the puzzle at this point. We're under $20 million from projected trust fund transfers going through each year of the plan. What is bigger is the tax and significant fee changes. We have two kinds. One is continuing tax and fee changes, or recurring. Those also have to be stacked as we go out into the last year, but these are permanent or essentially permanent tax changes or fee changes. And so we have to keep them going year after year. What has been very remarkable in Florida over the last couple of years is how we have invested into the one-time or time-limited tax and fee changes. And you can see when you look at our averages there, that's the biggest part. So we've blocked $541 million for those time-limited tax and fee changes every single year of the plan. That's our tax holidays. So that's things like the back-to-school holiday, the hurricane holiday, Freedom Summer, all of those holidays. So we've, over the last couple of years, have had large investment in these holidays. So that is the single biggest thing we had to take account of in the revenue adjustments. So if you look across in total, taking all of those things into effect, we run from about $627 million to $896 million in terms of cost for those each year. Putting it together and looking at just the first year, we have a projected ending balance that's very strong, even after taking care of the needs, the recurring revenue adjustments, the one-time revenue adjustments, and maintaining a reserve of $1.8 billion. After taking all of those into account, we still have $7 billion that would be available to run into the following year, funding this conservative view of our long-range financial outlook in year one. But what you notice is about 57.8% of this is non-recurring dollars. We show you this chart just to show you what changed from what we knew last year. So last year when we had 24-25 in our long-range financial outlook, we had certain assumptions that we were making. This compares where we are this year to then. The biggest difference is the balance forward from 23-24. You can see it's about $6.7 billion lower than what we thought we would have in last year's long-range financial outlook. That largely had to do with the fact that we had a larger budget than we were projecting in our conservative view. The biggest positive is $3.6 billion that's coming from the change in the revenue estimates over multiple years relative to what we knew last year. But altogether, revenues are down about 6% relative to what we projected last year. On the other side, projected expenditures are up about 9.2%. Part of that's coming from a larger base budget coming into 24-25 from this year, but also our new budget drivers from 24-25 are more expensive than what we were looking at last year. So altogether, we're about $7.6 billion lower. That means that we're 51.9% lower than last year's projection for this year. So a much tighter look, but still positive than what we had. This is the bottom line across all 3 years. You can see the $7 billion that's coming out of year one drops to $5.36 billion as we move into year two, and drops to $2.7 billion as we move into year three. Positive numbers all across the board for this look, which is the very good news. We have had negatives in one or more years when we've done this analysis in past years, so very positive. But you can see by the time we get to the third year, virtually all of our projected surplus or remaining balance is coming from non-recurring dollars. You can really see that on this slide. We start with a seven, of which about 4.1 is coming from non-recurring dollars. That amount stays roughly the same as we move into the second year, but our recurring number starts dropping. And by the time we get to the third year, the 2.7, virtually all of that 2.7, all but $130 million of it, is going to be non-recurring dollars. So no fiscal strategies are needed in the short run. It's good news in the short run. We don't have any negatives, but there is a cautionary note or a warning note coming from the fact that that balance is dropping so much over the 3 years. And so that's just a factor to keep in mind in budgeting. If you, for example, were to spend all of the $7 billion this year for the 24-25 budget, you would have significant negative ending balances as you move into the second and third year of the outlook. So it's just a cautionary note that should be kept in mind. These have not significantly change. These are the issues that we don't build into our forecast. We don't think they are probable, but they are possible. They're just less probable than other things that we include. But we point them out as risks to bear in mind. The first one, which works really well after Chris's presentation, is that the realization that while we have a big enough ending balance that we can handle even very significant hurricanes, Hurricane Ian would be an example, that if you had multiple events co-occurring, for example, at extreme parts of the state, it would be challenging. It would be challenging to our cash flow, but it would also be challenging on our human capital and technical resources. So that's something to keep in mind as co-occurring risks. Still today, although the answer may be out there by now, is the concern about a protracted and complete federal government shutdown. It's not a shutdown that lasts a week or two that we worry about here, but shutdowns that work that last 5 weeks or more. So how long it lasts has a very big effect on what kind of stress we would see as a state and on our citizens. And it does affect our economy. As we're speaking, the next shutdown, if no action is taken, would occur Friday night at midnight. But there's meetings taking place even as we're speaking to try to come up with a resolution to that and keep that from happening. And then the final thing is we still worry about the Federal Reserve, that the economy is in such an unusual place that there could be a Federal Reserve miscue. We don't think that's probable, but if some actions of theirs drove us into a recession or a deep recession or unabated inflation, that would have a very big impact on our budget in Florida. And then we've been using this chart to kind of show where we are. So we think of those as rings. If you remember back to the earlier part of this presentation, inflation is still with us. It's abating, but it is still with us. We know from data releases that savings that had built up during COVID have reduced significantly, and for some households, they're gone. And as they lose their ability to tap into savings, household debt increases. And we know from the most recent releases that have just come out, in fact, that household debt is increasing, particularly for credit card balances. So we're seeing those really start to move up. That means we're also starting to see delinquency rates move up. All of that will be coloring the forecast that we put together as we next meet, which is this final slide. So we've had a couple of things happen since we put the Legislative Budget Commission adopted the long-range financial outlook. We've, on October 10th, adopted a series of new retrospects, which is a big accounting reconciliation that we do once a year, new outlooks. As a result of all of those adjustments, relative to where we were in September, we added roughly another $1 billion to our balance. So we moved from that 8.8 official number that I was pointing out to you earlier for this year by June 30th to 9.8. So that is one piece. So that was an improvement over what the Legislative Budget Commission knew. The second thing that has happened is on October 23rd, the Florida Retirement System Actuarial Assumption Conference met, and we looked at a preliminary set of numbers for the Florida Retirement System. just slightly higher than what we had built in as a placeholder in the long-range financial outlook. So not significantly changing what we knew one way or another. We won't get the final numbers for the Florida retirement system until December, when all the assumptions we adopted get built in. But we're not expecting at this point any great surprise there from what we were expecting. And then the final piece of things that have happened is special session C, where we did a number of things, including some group of expenditures. That was about $427 million in expenditures for 23-24 for the current year. If we moved into 24-25, we'd also pick up a little bit of Idalia tax relief, but just looking at 23-24, that would reduce that balance that we increased in the first block, but it doesn't wipe it out. So we have, relative to what the LBC knew, you have about $618 million more than they were aware of when they adopted the plan in September. And then all of the driver numbers, in addition to the decisions you're going to be making on priorities, will be affected by the next estimating conference season. So it officially starts on November 28th, 2023, with a new demographic forecast. That's right after Thanksgiving. It'll run through January 16th, 2024, which is when we adopt the new general revenue forecast. So that'll all be new factors as you move through the process. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Members, do we have any questions? Representative Williams.
Thank you very much, sir. Can you go back to slide 8, where you spoke about the housing problem that we're having now? You spoke of $5.4 billion. Can you tell me how does that impact our population now in the crisis that we're having for housing?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your question.
I'm sorry. You spoke of $5.4 billion. Can you tell me how would that impact the population of housing crisis that we're having now?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Ms. Baker.
So hidden in these numbers, I mean, is good news and bad news. So when we surged to the 5.4, it was good news for revenue collections. It was good news for the Land Acquisition Trust Fund and some of the environmental programs it funds. But beneath that is the fact that you had a lot of people who were facing very strong price appreciation, very strong housing costs were increasing a lot. So that is a burden to the citizens in Florida. But on the other hand, there was a lot of people during that period of time that got into housing arrangements for their first time, perhaps. So this number encompasses a host of different situations. At a minimum, we like to see house price appreciation come down and not be at a frenzied pace. So in that respect, as we came out of the $5.4 billion one-time windfall and came back down to a lower level and back down to a lower level again this year, That is a better situation for people trying to buy houses that have the means to buy houses. It is not a good situation for the people trying to sell housing because they're facing very high, the fact that the people they would sell to would have very high interest rates.
Representative Williams, you recognize?
Thank you very much. So from the $5.4 billion, as of now, where are we with that?
Just for the purposes of the members, I don't understand your question. Can you explain your question?
Okay, the $5.4 billion is from 21-22 year. As of 2023, where are we right now?
Okay, Ms. Baker.
So these are the years that are completed years. So 21, 22 is a completed year. 22, 23 is a completed year. Our estimate for the year we're in now is that we would come down another 10% from 21, 22. So it'd be about 90% of the level we have there. When the estimating conference meets, they'll reshoot that projection, but it'd be about 90% of the last year.
So, Ms. Baker, that's the number that's listed on that slide, right? Yeah. So that number's on the slide, Representative Williams.
I'm sorry, it's the completed year, 22-23, that's on the slide.
Right.
So the forecast year that we're in isn't on the slide. That would be about 90% of that level.
Is there any further questions? Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Slide 22, you indicated was a caution for us. So I just, when you get there, that's a decrease in general revenue, I believe, over a 3 or 4 year period of time. I'm concerned that you're cautioning us about that, and can we maybe dive a little bit deeper into why it's declining and what we can do about it, about that?
Ms. Baker.
It's really saying be mindful of how you make your new investments. So the long-range financial outlook is just looking at what's in place today. It's not, and growth. It's not presupposing new programs and new investments. So really what this slide is saying is to be cautious in how you make your new investments. Be aware that the money needs to last multiple years if we want to stay on this track, and be aware that the bulk of the money that you have available to you is non-recurring money. So one-time investments or time-limited investments are going to be have less effect on those out years than major new recurring programs.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to talk a little bit about the structural imbalance or the revenue shortfall. Am I correct in understanding that in plain English, the structural imbalance or the coming revenue shortfall is just a way of saying we're on course to spend more money than we take in revenues if we don't adjust our priorities?
Ms. Baker.
We've had so many one-time investments over the last couple years that picture's a little bit muddied. And normally you would say yes. That means that your expenditure needs are outpacing what your revenue sources are. But we had that large one-time balance of $19.8 billion and have had it for a while. So we've been whittling down on that slowly. So it doesn't have quite the same meaning that it normally would have. If you went out one more year from the 3 years that we're showing here, you would lose your recurring. But it really just has to do with, would you have as significant a number of one-time investments going forward as we've had in the last couple of years?
Ms. Baker, do you see a structural imbalance here?
It is hinting that we need to be cautious, but within these 3 years, there is not a structural imbalance.
Thank you. I just want to clarify that. Any further questions? Representative Driscoll for a follow-up.
Thank you. So could we talk a bit about, could you explain how we account for tax cuts or tax credits in this outlook?
Ms. Baker, I believe you did that, yeah. Right? Did you have a specific question about the tax cuts?
Yeah, let's talk about this. I mean, is it fair to say, I mean, from an accounting perspective, or maybe how it's considered by this body, is there a difference at the end of the day on the balance sheet between maybe like spending money on a service and allocating money to a tax cut? In other words, are the tax cuts contributing to this trajectory that we're on that could lead us to have a structural imbalance in 4 years? are tax cuts, I mean, I know I'm asking compound questions, but I'm just trying to illuminate the, you know, what I'm trying to get at, which is whether or not as we are considering these policy choices, we also need to be mindful at tax cuts, because you could almost look at that as a spending decision, right? If we're making a decision to take in less money here, but we're spending more on non-reoccurring projects and initiatives there, you know, do we need to take into account the impact that tax cuts might have on our long-range planning and this sort of this course that we're on that could lead us to a structural imbalance if we're not careful?
Members, so use this as an example. That's a lot of windup for a question. We've got 6 minutes left, and a number of people still have questions. So if you could address whether we need to take into account tax cuts and their impact on revenue, that would be appreciated.
We didn't always include revenue adjustments in our projections, but for the kind of the discussion that you were leading us down, we did start including them because it is, in effect, another kind of spending decision. So its effect are just the same things you would take into account with a budget decision. So in a budget decision, you'd be thinking about, is it recurring? Is it non-recurring? Is it a one-time investment? Or is it something we want to permanently engage in? That's exactly the same rationale that comes from the revenue adjustments. So its effect on the bottom line would, in this respect, be exactly the same.
So I think the short answer is yes, and I'm sorry, I'm going to move us along because I know Representative Hunchowski had some questions as well. Representative Hunchowski, you recognize.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I had a question on slide 23, the black swan. So it mentioned that the consumer price index increased 3.7%, but what I noticed there is that 70% of the total increase was accounted for regarding shelter. Is this a national number or is this a Florida-specific number? And the only reason I ask that is because we have a very different scenario from many other areas of the state regarding the property insurance crisis and housing affordability.
Ms. Baker, a brief answer. Members, I'm going to remind you, keep your wind up short.
National. It's a national number.
Representative Hunchowski.
Yeah, is there a way for us to determine what the state number would be? Because this could be deceiving if it's in here and it's not a state-focused
Ms. Baker?
Number.
We don't have a data set that reports it. It's something we can calculate as needed, but we don't have a separate data set that reports it.
Would the assumption be that...
Representative Hunchowski for final follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Would the assumption be that it would be higher in the state of Florida due to our higher shelter costs?
Ms. Baker, if you know.
I wouldn't want to make that assumption without looking at the data.
All right. Representative Daly, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Baker, thank you for the presentation. I guess jumping back to slide 13, where you talked about the critical needs drivers, talked about using some of the funds from trust funds to pay down those critical needs drivers to avoid putting more pain, I guess, on general revenue. Is that standard? And are those trust fund dollars ideally supposed to be used for that? And are they replenished to the same extent that we are using them?
Ms. Baker.
It is standard. It's a common strategy that we use to look at either the three-year financial outlook or some of our estimating conferences like Medicaid. There's some where the trust fund is so closely aligned, it's serving the same purpose.
I'm going to let Representative Skidmore have the last question of the day. Representative Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Baker. Quickly, the influx of residents, people coming into Florida, plus the age of our population growing, how does that impact the employment numbers in relation to, we have a doctor shortage, a nurse shortage, a low unemployment rate? I'm curious about how the workforce projections are looking in relation to all that increased population and aging. Are we gonna have enough people to take care of all the people who are moving here?
Ms. Baker.
There's a labor market estimating conference that's relatively new and it's been looking at some of those issues. Healthcare is going to be a significant factor in terms of having enough healthcare workers to cover, particularly our senior population. We can get that information.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. And I'm going to invite all the members, if you would reach out to Ms. Baker directly with any additional questions. We have a run up on the end of the meeting. So this concludes our committee agenda. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Garrison moves that we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, Ms. Baker.